you open Megillas Esther, which we've done in the past, but this morning you had a chance to actually open and focus and actually read the Psukim and not just assume that we know what it says because we heard the story before. You actually spent a few minutes with the Chavrusa actually looking at the Psukim of the first parak and actually asking yourself, Vashteit, Vashishver, what does it say? And what's difficult? What doesn't stim? So let's go through the parak briefly, or I'd love to do right now. We'll go through the parak, and as we go through the parak, you'll tell me your kashas. Everyone's writing down kashas. We'll go through pasuk by pasuk, you'll tell me your kashas. And then let's see where this leads us. So now looking at the board, I think we on the board have a fair number of kashas. From the beginning to the end of the parak, all these details, let's just recap briefly some of the kashas that came up. And then let's see where this takes us, particularly with Yoel's ha'ara before, which will be key. Now, from the beginning of the parak, so the introduction of Achashverosh is very intensive. The Hu Achashverosh, I heard you the first time. The Hodu Bakush, the Machlokes, Hodu Kush are far away, close. What's that all about? That why is he described as sitting on his throne in Pasuk Beis? And then by Yalam Ahim, and then the in Pasuk Gimel, the invitation, L'chol Sarav, with a very specific invitation list that seems to go backwards. First the Avadim, and then the Chayalim, soldiers, and finally the Sarim, where by royal protocol you would think the Chashuvim come first. Here the Chashuvim, the Sari Amidinos. Yeah, probably was not thinking of Ma'am Kippakosh Lamarib. And then the 108-day party, which is the Lagamre, totally bizarre, and the focus, as Eitan pointed out, on the location, the Chatzar Ginas Bisan HaMelech, for the second party of 7 days. And the incredible amount of detail. The incredible amount of detail in terms of decor matches that only matched in the Tanakh, probably only by Mikdash, by Mishkan, by Beis HaMikdash.
Wouldn't some of the decor from the Beis HaMikdash?
It may have been. It may have been.
Rash doesn't even
point that out. Oh. And then moving ahead, when we meet Vashti, Trevor pointed out, Achashverosh gets such an intensive introduction. Vashti gets no intro. We're not sure why she's making a women's party. They definitely were not. It was not a Mahadran Sneha situation, to put it mildly. And if she's making a party, the fact it was pointed out, the location is given as being on the grounds of Melech Achashverosh. She's told to show up dafka with the Kesar Malchus. Why? She's told to show up in order to show off her good looks. A strange thing for an emperor to do. Again, maybe he was just drunk. And Davka, she's meant to be hauled away like an animal by the Sarisim. She can't even come on her own power. We understand why she's not happy. And then we meet the Sarisim. A lot of focus on the names of the Sarisim. And as you pointed out, Kedas Malasos. As though he's asking the Sarisim what the laws are. Who's in charge here? Who's the boss? And then at the end, all of a sudden there's a Devar Malchus Milafanav, a royal proclamation, which begins, strangely, with banning Vashti from coming to the king. And Tavo is future tense, not past tense. And then, when it's actually put out, the last pasuk of the parak, we meet for the first time this why all of a sudden are we stressing? It's sent out however it's sent out. Whatever the protocol was, that's what they did. And the Leo's Kodesh at the very end, to make a rule for the king, emperor to issue an edict about how every single marriage in his empire is supposed to work. That's a strange rule for the realm. Now, I want to point you to one other thing. If you look back, once Vashti appears, notice carefully, how is she referred to? How do we name her? Pasuk Tesh is Vashti Hamalka. Right? Vashti Hamalka made this party in Achashverosh's Beis Hamalchus. And Pasuk Gedalev, Achashverosh says, bring Vashti Hamalka. Pasuk Yud, and Pasuk later, Pasuk Tezayin and Yud Zayin, when Memuchan is talking about it, she is Vashti Hamalta. But Pasuk Yud Beis, Tima Ein Hamalka Vashti. Queen, not Vashti, the queen, but Queen Vashti is the one who refuses. And Pasuk Tezvav, when Achashverosh is still grappling with this, before Memuchan comes on the scene, he's talking about Kedas Malasos Ba Malka Vashti. Is she Vashti a Malka or Malka Vashti?
I think for purposes, the test in Yoda and Yidal, and later on, I think it's because the other ones were from other people's perspectives of, let's go get Vashti a Malka, whereas this one is from, Vashti is telling them, no, so she is a Malka Vashti.
Fantastic. So Yolo's picking up on his horror from before and moving it forward, which is the following. And in doing so, maybe we should call you Meir Leibush for today, because you're mechaven deeply to the Malbim. So the Malbim points out that this is what's driving the entire parak. And as I said earlier today, b'chalal, the whole parak is sarachian. Not just these 1,001 details you have on the board, over 20 kashas, but the whole parak, as we said earlier this morning, the whole parak could have been left out. Well, what does it do for the story? You need to know that Vashti died, it was eliminated. Okay, so say, Achashverosh had a party, he had a falling out with Vashti, he got rid of Vashti. Shai, move on. A pasuk or two. I mean, that pasuk of Vav in particular was all those details about the decor, but the whole parak is full of details that seem totally unnecessary. So the answer to that, I think, and the Malbim has different thoughts about the parak as a whole, it could be that the parak really stands on its own. Yitachein, that in a chanami, for the rest of the story, we didn't need the whole parak. It could be, to a certain extent, parak alpha is meant to stand on its own, as its own story, with its own lesson for us. How so? So we come back to Yoel Zahara, the Malcolm Zahara. That its core, as the Gemara points out, Achashverosh was not born into royalty. Achashverosh married up. Achashverosh had common origins, as you pointed out. Achashverosh took a tremendous social leap forward in marrying a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar, Vashti, who had royal blood in her veins. But even Achashverosh, who Achashverosh? In the days of Achashverosh, people still remembered him as Mr. Achashverosh. It hadn't been so long ago. He hadn't gradually worked his way up from, you know, city government, then became a state assemblyman, and then became a congressman and a senator, and gradually working his way up the ladder. No, he had leapt up the ladder in a very, very rapid rise to power. So much so, the Malbim suggests, people still remember the old Achashverosh. It had been only a couple of years ago that guys were, you know, dropping off their horse with Achashverosh, or having beers in the bar with Achashverosh. He was one of the guys. He's one of the guys who, in a couple of years, he's the emperor of the realm. Even Achashverosh, who was still Achashverosh, still that old guy. Hamolech. Hamolech, not Melech. Hamolech. Mom points out, he is now ruling. Like, in the recent past, he wasn't doing any of this. All of a sudden, now, he's ruling, and ruling a massive empire. Hodu and Kush, as you point out, the Gemara is Machlokas. Whether Hodu and Kush are far or near, and I think Rabbi Yisrael Belsky pointed out, where are they? Look at the map. Where are they? The answer is, there's more than one Kush. Hodu is India. Kush is Ethiopia. But there's a mountain range in India called, in the Indian vicinity of India, called the Hindu Kush mountain range. So there are two different places called Kush. That's why it's Macholkes Rav Shmuel the Gemara. What's the Pasuk trying to say? You see how powerful emperor he was? That his empire stretched over much of the known world, from India to Ethiopia, which is tremendous. If you think about it, think about that on the map. Or are we trying to say that he has such a powerful grip on power, as though his, you know, if he had a very small zone that he was in charge of, he could have a firm grip on power. As your empire grows, it becomes harder and harder to maintain hegemony over that whole area. But he had it all. He controlled the whole area, thousands of miles, as though it was Hodu and Kush right next to each other. Either way, he has very, very quickly became an incredibly powerful man. he very, very quickly stepped up into running the whole show, being the emperor of much of the known world. But the Chevra still remembered just a couple of years ago, Achashverosh. He was that guy. He was the guy we used to hang out with. And Achashverosh realizes, as Yoel pointed out, that his hold on power is largely because of his wife. Achashverosh realizes, moreover, that in the context of the Persian Empire, the emperor, the king, had a lot of power, but he was what we would call in our language a constitutional monarch. He had power, but there were rules. There was this post-Glorious Revolution, for those who know the British history, when the king has power, but he shares it, he has a role to play, but he's not an unfettered ruler. He has to contend with parliament, he has to contend with the nobles. And the Malbim points out four differences between a constitutional monarch and an absolute monarch. Four differences. One is he bound by the laws? Are there rules that govern even the king? Or does he get to do whatever he pleases? Number two, who makes the rules? Does he make the rules himself? Or does he have to do it in conjunction with parliament, in conjunction with the Senate, in conjunction with the Tsarim? Number three, who owns the money? The royal treasury. It belongs to the empire, and he's supposed to be taking care of it and using it on behalf of the empire, or it's his personal slush fund. And number four, who gets to decide where the capital is? If it's a constitutional monarchy, so there's a set capital. But if he's in total control, if he's an absolute monarch, he can move it to wherever he wants. And now everything, the whole perek, falls into beautiful place. How does it start? We're introduced to this Achashverosh, the upstart, who had very, very quickly moved from being a commoner to being ruler of most of the known world. But everyone still remembers his old past. And everyone remembers that, he's really king because of his wife. And he's itching. He's not interested in this limited monarchy. He wants to consolidate power. He wants to lock it all in. He wants to become an absolute monarch, which will help everyone forget. He wants everyone to forget that there ever was a non-king Achashverosh. But that's why for the rest of the Megillah we're going to hear about, starting with Pasuk Beis, HaMelech Achashverosh. But we're introduced to him first. He was just a guy. Achashverosh, who had been just a guy not long ago. And now, they had already been a palace at Persepolis. But Achashverosh moves the center of power to this new palace in Susa, in Shushan, that had been excavated. He wants to show that he's in charge. So what does he do? Number one, he moves the palace. Number two, and that's why in Pasuk Bey is the focus on Kisa Machuz Hashem Shushan Abira. Good. And then we pack on to Pasuk Gimel. What's the next step in his plan to consolidate power and to transform himself from a limited constitutional monarch into an unlimited absolute monarch? Step number one was moving the center of power. I'm in charge. I decide where my throne is. Step number two is I'm going to make the most ridiculous party anyone has ever seen. Totally over the top. First, 180 days. Who's spending all this money? What gives you the right, the treasurer must have said to him, to spend all this money? I mean, we have a budget. And he says, budget? I'm in charge. This is my money. Get out of my face. I'm an absolute monarch. I'll spend money the way I want to. And the ultimate snub. He invites all of his staff to the first party, but in reverse order. What, the Avadim and the Chayalim come before the Sari Amedinos? The Sari Amedinos are the most powerful people after the king. This is the Senate. This is the parliament. These are the heads of provinces. And Achashverosh is saying, no more. You're zero. You're not in power anymore. You're just in power because of me. In which case, my personal avadim, my personal footmen, my personal soldiers are more chashiv than the governors of provinces because they have more to do with me. It's all about me. And then to make it even worse, he makes a party for the populace, for the common folk, and, as Eitan pointed out, invites them dafke into Chatzar Ginas Pisan HaMelech. He invites them onto palace grounds. What a violation of royal protocol. Only Chashudim should be invited into the royal garden. But it's exactly Achashverosh's point. You're all the same to me. No one's Chashud except me. I am everything, is Achashverosh's message. All power is consolidated in me. Everyone else is the same. It doesn't matter whether you're a governor or you're a commoner. It doesn't matter. You're all not me. You're all paupers, and I hold all the power. So everyone can be invited because it's all about me. And I can trample over traditions because I'm totally in power. He's demonstrating his absolute power by moving his throne. He's demonstrating his absolute power by moving the capital city. He's demonstrating his absolute power, number two, by spending as he wishes. He's demonstrating his absolute power, number three, by showing the Sarim repeatedly that they are no longer anything special. And number four, by trampling on tradition. I can do whatever I want. And then he goes for the jugular. And then he goes for the gold. As you all pointed out, now he's demonstrated that everyone needs to cower before me. No one has any power. I have it all. One last piece in the puzzle. He has to show everyone definitively, I'm not about Vashti. Vashti is about me. I'm not in charge because of her royal blood. I'm in charge because I'm King Achashverosh, and that's the beginning and end of everything. And so to do that, he does what otherwise seems unthinkable. He was drunk. He was disinhibited enough that he was willing to do this. But it wasn't a silly thing to do. It was a horrific thing to do. But it was also a very strategic thing to do. He was thinking. And he said, we're going to show everyone that Vashti is just a pretty girl. I'm married to her because I like her. That's it. I don't need her. It's hard to even say these words. Such a vile person. I don't need her for power. I just want her because she's pretty. I'm going to show the world, mamash, Achashverosh says, I'm going to show the world how pretty she is. In other words, I just married her because she's pretty. Nothing more, nothing less. And that's why she wants to make her own party. Vashti understands what's going on here. Vashti realizes that these parties aren't just bacchanalian orgy. She realizes that her husband is making a power play, and she's not going to stand for it. So she says, I'm making a party too. To which he responds, okay, but on my terms and my turf. It's going to be in the space of Melech Achashverosh. You're not doing your own independent thing. And 7 days later, on day seven, he tells the Sarisim, haul her here like an animal. Biyada Sarisim, with the Keser Malchus. Show everyone how pretty she is. He wants to show everyone, Vashti is not the source of my power.
Why would she have the
Keser Malchus then? His Keser Malchus. In other words, yeah. Show her that she's just me. She's just an extension of me, as opposed to reality, which is that he is an extension of her. And that's why he says, bring Vashti HaMalka. Vashti HaMalka can make a party on my terms. Vashti HaMalka has to come. She's Vashti first and Malka second. And when Memuchan talks about it, he reiterates in Psukim Tazayin Yedzayin, Vashti HaMalka. She's merely Vashti, your queen. But when Vashti pushes back, Queen Vashti, she's queen first. She's like, I'm not having any of this. What, you're going to show me off as a piece of garbage? I'm just your plaything? Your power comes from me, let's be clear. You're not going to delete or airbrush out that fact. I'm Hamalka Vashti, and I'm not coming. And at first, Achashverosh is thrown. So much so that he comes to the Sarisim and the Pasuk Tezav asks, Kedas Mala Sos Bamalka Vashti. Number one, he's still referring to her as Hamalka Vashti. She is asserting herself. And as you pointed out, someone pointed out before, he's asking for the rules. And he's asking the Sarisim and the Sarim, what are the rules? In other words, he's reverting back. He was thrown by Vashti's pushback, by Vashti's assertiveness. He's sort of stepping back to, well, I have to see what all the Sarim say. What are the rules? I can't trample on the rules. I can't act independently. What do the Sarim say? Vashti is Hamalka Vashti. She's asserting herself. What do I do now? In steps Memuchan, who says, Your Royal Highness, she's Vashti Hamalka, and we're going to double down on that. Pasuk Tezayin. Memuchan says, she's Vashti Hamalka, and we're gonna double down. We're going to push back. We're going to push back. And what happens? Imam HaMelech Toh, he would come to the proclamation. Dvar Malchus. What's a Dvar Malchus? Number one, where is it coming from? The king himself. Not from the Sarim. It's reasserting. The king himself is totally powerful. Dvar Malchus Milafanav. A permanent Dvar Malchus. And what's the first rule? We're going to rewrite history. Like all good dictators. Like all vile dictators. Like all effective, horrifically effective dictators, Ahasuerus engages in a little bit of historical revisionism. We're going to rewrite the story a little bit to make a fair narrative. So he says, Vashti is now banned. Implying, yeah, she didn't come, and then she got in trouble. And if we're saying Vashti is now banned, like Lahavdol Alfei Havdolos, if there's in the Justinian Code, the Roman code of law that was promulgated a couple of centuries after Churban Bayis Sheni, if there's a law in there that Jews are not allowed to bring Karban Pesach in the Beis HaMikdash and the Makom HaMikdash on the 14th of Nisan, what does that tell you? The law is only written a couple hundred years after Churban Bayis. Says the Maariv, well, if they were making a law you can't do it, obviously means there were Jews who were trying to do it. Apparently there were Jews who were trying to bring Karban Pesach even after the Churban Bayis. So Lahavdol Alfei Havdolos, so too here. If Ahasuerus is sending out to the entire empire a law that comes from him alone and says, number one, Vashti is hereby banned from appearing before my royal presence. Asher lo tavo Vashti, naivin Vashti Amalka, plain Vashti, Mrs. Vashti, cannot come before HaMelech Ahasuerus. What does that tell you? The Vashti is trying to. In other words, that's going to get the word out falsely that Vashti feels terrible. And Vashti is trying to come on her hands and knees and beg forgiveness from Ahasuerus. And Ahasuerus is saying, no. Very clever rewriting. As though Vashti wants desperately to be pardoned by the king, who's refusing, instead says, U'malchusa yitena melchul rusa tov imena. So this is a brilliant strategic move, horrific, and brilliant. Mad genius, yes. He says, oh, we're going to part this law. It's going to come only from me, says Memuchan. It'll come only from you, Your Highness. And it's going to say that Vashti's not allowed to come before you, implying that she's trying to. But this is a matter of state. And then, finally, at the very end, what's with the last pasuk? They actually send out the letters, and the king adds a bit. Memuchan just said, send a letter that Vashti is banned, that Vashti can be replaced, and women should respect their husbands. Ahasuerus takes it and runs with it. Not just women should respect their husbands, but that women are, he like converts them to like the chattel property of their husbands. Leos kol ish sorer beveso. Every husband is like totally the king of his home. Like women are garbage. That was Ahasuerus' first law. Vashti is not allowed to come before me. She's banned. Women are garbage. This is what Ahasuerus is saying. And bidina bidina kichzava va'am va'am kolshono. Every nation in its own language. Every nation in its own text, its own script. What's with that? Because Ahasuerus is once again stressing that, number one, I will trample on any preceding custom. I can change the way we do things. It used to be everyone had to converse with the king in Persian, presumably, or Aramaic, the lingua franca. Achashverosh is, as he did with the Sarim, you're all the same. It doesn't matter. I'm the only power. There are no other powers here, says Achashverosh. So we'll do that. I'll write to you in your own language because you're all the same. And he's going to assert his power over everyone to the extent that I will redefine the nature of every single marriage relationship in my empire. What could be more invasive than that? I'm going to get my tentacles, Achashverosh is saying, inside every single home. A lot of shades of Soviet Russia. Like, mama, like, you're changing the way the language people use. You change the way their families are structured. Mama's like getting inside everything. Why? And here's where the irony comes. Ad Kan, we saw this from the perspective through the eyes of Achashverosh. What was Achashverosh's goal?
Make them respect
him. Total power. Total power. I will be the most powerful man. I will be the only powerful man. And here's the irony. In trying to get total power, who gets pushed around in this parak more than anyone else? Achashverosh. His wife doesn't listen to him. Memuchan tells him what to do. Memuchan gets him to do the most... In trying to be super powerful, he looks like a total buffoon. Really? Your first royal edict? Your first major royal enterprise is to make a drunken parties for over half a year. You're acting like a buffoon. And then, when it's all over, you get rid of your queen for no good reason, because of a drunken orgy, and you send out a letter that's the most absurd thing in the world. Really? Your first royal edict, your first imperial edict, is telling people how they should run their own families? Absurd. He sounds like a fool. Achashverosh, in his quest to become the most powerful man, ends up, ironically, being totally pushed around and totally controlled by everyone else. He's the man with the least power. Everyone else is drinking his wine. Everyone else is enjoying his money. He looks like a fool. He sounds like a fool. He acts like a fool. Everyone else is pushing him around. Yeah, right. And when it's all over, he probably, it's a very good point. If anything, he probably reinforced. By the time this, 6 months and change were over, he had probably, Adrab, as you say, reinforced the fact that he's just old Achashverosh. We used to have beers with him in the bar. Now he's doing a much grander scale, but he's no more sophisticated. He's no more wise. He's no more in control than he used to be. That's the irony of the first parak. And now we can sort of wrap things up. Now we can wrap it all together. As I suggested before, the Malbim, it doesn't say exactly this, but Al-Derech HaMalbim, at the end of the parak, it could be, in trying to understand why is this parak here, Bechlal, who needs parak Al for the rest of the story? It's not just that all the Tanam except Rabbi Meir hold, lane it. Why is it in the Tanakh at all? So it could be, at least in part, as I suggested before, it stands as a separate work, like a separate unit. We'll get to the story of Purim later. But this is the story of Achashverosh. And Perek Aleph has its own lesson for us. There's a little bit of Achashverosh inside each of us. A teeny, teeny, tiny bit. Much more mild, Baruch Hashem. Much, much, much more mild. But there is a little bit of Achashverosh inside every person. By which I mean this desire for total control and total power, which to a certain extent is reasonable and healthy in a very, very mild way. You want to control your own environment in normal, healthy ways. You want to control your own life. You want to control your own destiny. A reasonable thing to want, though we know ultimately that while efforts are on us, results are on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we have the schus of being invited by the Ribbono Shel Olam to be junior partners with him in our destiny. We're junior partners with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our own lives. He wants our involvement. He wants efforts to be on us. He wants us to be mishtadel. He gives us bechir chavshes. And ultimately, decisions are being made by him. Environment is decided by him. and decisions are decided on him, but efforts are on us. We have the schus to be junior partners, but only junior partners in our story, in our destiny. Junior partners with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. To be a part of the Kadosh Baruch Hu is unbelievable schus. But to get carried away and think that you're in charge of everything is gaiva and sheker and really dangerous. And to get carried away even more and think that you're in control of other people and that you're the most important person in your sphere and that everyone should just be bowing down to you, if not literally, then figuratively, you will come across in life people who get that carried away by gaiva. Delusions of grandeur, and they think that they're God's gift to the world and everyone should be kowtowing to them and everyone should just be recognizing them. And here's the irony. When you think you're in total control, often you end up being the biggest fool. And when you think you're going to achieve total power, often you end up with the least power. Kol barech achar kavod, the Mishnah Pirkei Avos says, kavod runs away from you. And by the end of the story, the people who are actually running the show, initially people running the show were Haman. By the end, the people running the show are Mordechai and Esther. Achashverosh is not throughout, really, the man. There's power behind the throne. It's not him. That's part of the irony of the Megillah. Aside from everything else, aside from it being a star of Ashkacha Pratis, and Kadosh Baruch Hu taking care of us, and Nisim Nistarim, and all the other angles, the first parak highlights a focus on Midos, and a focus on Anava, and a focus on being honest with yourself. If you're not so caught up with yourself, you'll accomplish a lot more. It'll make a lot more impact. When a person gets caught up in his own ego, the irony is it decreases your capacity to make impact. And it decreases the amount that people will actually respect you. Being a Baal Gaiva doesn't help any which way. It just distorts your vision and deflates you in ways you don't even realize. Achashverosh thinks that he succeeded. By the end of the pack, Achashverosh thinks that he's the most powerful man and everyone respects him. No one respects him. He looks like a fool, and he's being controlled by everyone else. He's Kalim Biyad Kalev. He thinks he's running the show, but all the people he thinks he's in charge of, they're actually running him. We all struggle with Gaiva. There's always that Achashverosh within. And the first parak alone, as we saw again, we took the time to actually sit in Beis Medrash with an open sefer and actually go through the psukim of the first parak. A parak we have heard more than 20 times in our lives. And look at that. We actually, with open eyes, learn the psukim and don't take them for granted. So many kashas come to the fore. Then as you dig deeper, there are patterns that emerge. Lessons that were hidden in plain sight that we finally discerned and discovered. Some of the many yesodos that we can glean from the Megillah and from the first parak in particular.